Good morning. We're right in the heart of the retreat now, so don't even think about going home. So I hope you are all abiding happily, at least some of the time, and maybe resting, maybe refreshing your minds, and hopefully getting some of the benefits of loving kindness meditation and more interested in the benefits that lay ahead, because there are countless benefits that are going to infuse your lives in ways you can't even predict. Not always the kind of lights and bliss and feelings of being loving, but a general sense that ill will is diminishing, your reactions are getting a little bit tempered, and you're opening your heart up to more of yourself, to more of life, and to other beings in a way that perhaps you weren't doing before. So the benefits are gradual, and I've said quite a lot about loving kindness, but I thought that today we could have a little bit of a deeper dive into the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which you've been chanting every morning, and have a look at some of the teachings in here, because it's not only a chant, as I hope you've noticed, it's a very meaningful teaching for us. And the Buddha's laying out some of the foundational qualities that are going to help you develop loving kindness in a really sustained way by making the foundation strong. So sometimes people feel, you know, do I have what it takes to practice meditation? Do I have what it takes to practice loving kindness? The fact is, there is no you in there that's fixed. And anyone can do this, provided that we, again, have the proper preparation in our mind. So we are all different, of course. Some of us, have more gratitude in general. Some of us naturally find that our minds settle into deep states of stillness. Others are more investigative in nature. Some of us have busy lives, so it might take longer for us to settle. Some of us, are more aversion-based, some of us are more greed-based, but this can change in time. But it really isn't important, and there's no such thing as ability or lack of ability. This is something I learned from my teacher, Ajahn Brahm. He really makes a big point of this, and he basically understands that everybody can practice given the right conditions. The Buddha said that the Dhamma can be heard by anyone with little dust in their eyes. And I think that really means just purifying our minds again, purifying our ways of looking, our lens, if you like, from the hindrances. And metta is a powerful way to do that. So, and also, we hopefully, through the practice of metta, are starting to learn how to open up a little bit to joy. Sometimes we think that should be obvious, right? That we should be able to receive joy. If it's there, of course we want that happiness, we want that bliss. And yet when it starts to come, we get a little bit freaked out. Oh, do I deserve it? Oh, it's a bit intense. Or the opposite reaction, wow, what is this? And then we lurch towards it. So of course this is natural, because we have the push-pull tendencies in the mind. We sometimes are a little bit suspicious or even afraid of new experiences, because they challenge actually who we think we are and how we have seen the mind behave so far. Right? So little by little with everything, but I wanted to talk about the foundations, because I don't think it can be said enough that virtue is the foundation for the whole path. And here we're going into a little bit more detail about some of these exact qualities that contribute and enable the metta practice to flourish beautifully. So, does that sound good?
Yeah.
All right. If it doesn't, then too bad. So, there are 15 qualities, and some of the translations that I have noted down are slightly different from the ones here, so we'll look at it in different ways. So the first one, of course, the first little paragraph here. This is what should be done, or this is what is to be done by one who knows where their own welfare lies. And I'm just giving a slightly different nuance to this, because it helps to open up the meaning sometimes. So here it says, one is skilled in goodness. The word is actually kusala, which means one's own. It does mean goodness, and also welfare, if you like. And who knows the path of peace, or who would break through to the path of peace. So the next one is, let them be able and upright, and here I have capable. So what does it mean to be capable? Capable of what? Capable of practicing loving kindness? And, you know, we can take this really back down to the fundamental basics of being fit and healthy. So the Buddha's advising us to look after our bodies, to make sure we get the right exercise, we eat well, we eat the food that suits us, we eat enough at the proper times, and also that we have a sense of energy, that we have some energy in our body and mind so that we're ready for the practice. And then the next ones I really like, this is Uju and Suju, upright and very upright, or here it says straightforward. And for me, this is about honesty and truthfulness, having a sense of integrity. And there's a little simile given in a book that I brought along. It's by Bhikkhu Nyanadasana, who was, I think, an Italian monk. And in there, he likens someone who's upright to a wheel that has its hub and its axis and its spokes all aligned. So it's a straight wheel that's not crooked or bent. So our minds are not crooked. We're not trying to kind of deceive people or pretend we're something we're not. And of course, that wheel, when you set it rolling, kind of carries itself as far as the momentum will allow. And it manages to stay straight on the path. Whereas the crooked mind, the mind that's trying to think, okay, how can I kind of twist things so that I look a little bit more shiny than I really am? Or how can I kind of avoid taking full responsibility here? Or sometimes we just act in ways that are a little bit hypocritical, you know. We have a certain ideology, but we act a bit differently to that. Or we just haven't found the courage yet to really stand up, maybe, for someone who's being oppressed. Even though we have, you know, the ideology that we want to include, we want to be allies, still when it comes to it, we're kind of protecting our own back. And this is not to judge this kind of thing, but I think to really learn to be completely upright means having a sense of kind of uncompromising integrity, that we start to, that our speech and actions align, right? And they also align with our value systems. So the wheel that's crooked is somebody who's, you know, deceitful in some way, who's not yet kind of managed to straighten out their mind and their behaviour, their verbal speech. And just as you might expect, you can send a crooked wheel rolling for a short time, but very soon it's going to start wobbling, and then it's going to kind of deviate from the path and probably end up in some kind of ditch somewhere, right? So it doesn't get very far. And you can see examples of this in the Buddha's own time. His own cousin, Devadatta. Does anyone know that story? His own cousin was apparently a very good meditator at first. So he must have been doing something right, and he even managed to practice to the point of, you know, experiencing some of the so-called psychic powers. So being able to hear from a long distance things that are being said far away, and to, I don't know if he had divine eye as well. But unfortunately, so of course he had deep meditation, and he must have had enough virtue to be able to establish those deep states of stillness. But he hadn't yet woken up to the Four Noble Truths. He wasn't enlightened. And instead of this leading to an understanding that the process is not an act of will, the process is actually a selfless process, and it's founded on these qualities rather than any innate or inherent superiority in a person, goodness or lack of goodness, he became very proud and quite conceited. And he actually started thinking he was better than the Buddha, so he ought to have his own disciples. And one of the things he actually did was to say that the Sangha should all be vegetarian, which is interesting, because there's nothing wrong with being vegetarian. In fact, I think if you can, health-wise and ethics-wise, it's a wonderful choice to make. Maybe these days it's easy enough to be vegan also. You know, it's kind of the new vegetarian, isn't it? It's if you're in a position to do so, it also has to be said that a vegan diet is not necessarily cheap. But it's good to make these kind of ethical choices if you possibly can to reduce and diminish the harm that our lives cause to other living beings who are more vulnerable than we are. Anyway, so he sort of did this not from really the motivation to protect life, but more from trying to show some kind of superiority and outdo the Buddha. So he managed to divide the Sangha into two, the followers of Devadatta and the followers of the Buddha. And he took it to such extremes that at one point he was so angry with the Buddha for being obviously more respected and awakened than he, that he sent a boulder down a hill where the Buddha was staying, and in an attempt to kill the Buddha. Unfortunately, only a chip came off that boulder, but a chip of rock, so it went into the foot of the Buddha and drew his blood, which is a really heinous thing to do. Like, it's considered one of the worst karmas you can make, to harm a Buddha. And so as a result of this crooked mind and these misguided intentions, he actually took rebirth in a lower realm. But they do say, Buddhism always has happy endings, they do say that eventually, because of his past practice, he will manage to come out of that lower realm and even maybe become a Buddha in the future. So there's hope for everybody, but for ourselves, we try to really refine our behaviour and bring it more and more fully onto the path and start to live with a real sense of integrity. And of course, that's going to mean that people trust you, that you can trust yourself, right? You can trust your own mind. And when people do befriend you, they befriend you for who you are, not for who you try to present yourself to be. So I really love these two qualities. And of course, they're aligned directly with the noble truths. I mean, in a sense, the Buddhist path is all about truth. We're trying to go from apparent truth to very subtle truth. So that has to begin by actually having truth in terms of speech and integrity in terms of who we are. So the next one is, so that these two are sort of refining each other. So being upright and very upright or straightforward. And the next one here says gentle in speech, but the translation I have is being easy to teach. And I think that's a nice one, because we have gentleness later in the Metta Sutta. So being easy to teach. I don't know, are you all easy to teach? I think you are. I actually feel like you know a lot of this. A lot of us do know the basic principles of the Dhamma. It's something that we hear and we recognise as true, isn't it? It's almost as though the teacher's just the reminder of something that we already know deep in our hearts. And so that makes us easy to teach. You know, we're receptive, again, not arrogant. We don't think we know everything already. Otherwise, we can't really learn anymore. So we need to be open and receptive and listen with an empty vessel, so to speak. There's a Zen story that talks about the full cup and the empty cup. And there's this disciple, I probably don't know the full story very well, but there's a disciple who's kind of coming to the teacher to ask him something. In this case, it's a he, of course, but anyway, could be a female. And the teacher basically says, I can't teach you anything because your cup is full. And he doesn't understand what he's talking about, but really what he means is his mind is full of his own ideas, his own views, and so whatever this person's taught will just, it won't really go inside. And sometimes we're like that, aren't we? We're listening with a kind of very critical mind to see if the teachings align with our own views or confirm our own views. And we're not actually being very receptive to what's being taught. Even I sometimes do that nowadays with Ajahn Brahm. I hear him give a talk and I think, oh, I know the joke that's coming next. So I kind of turn off, you know, because I've heard it before. But actually, he's often giving it a deeper meaning or a different nuance, and perhaps it's going to land differently because I'm never the same, right, from moment to moment. So that's my caveat. So if you've heard this before, that is not the beginner's mind. Empty your vessel and see what this brings up for you. Listen with the heart and not just with the head. So this is being easy to teach. And of course, in monastic life, that's a fundamental quality. Without being easy to teach, then nobody's going to take you on for training. Yeah, there's some place where the Buddha talks about trainees as horses. And he says that a person who just cannot learn is almost like dead to the training, like a dead horse. It's kind of vivid language. But I have, that has made sense to me sometimes in my life when I've tried, you know, to help a person and they're just not at the right, in the right place. You know, what they need is something different. Maybe the Dhamma is not, you know, they're not yet ready for that because the basic kind of maybe psychological wellness is not really straight. So sometimes we do need to address the issues that we have in different ways and not write ourselves off and think, oh, you know, I should already be meditating deeply. It's okay to get different kinds of support for different things that arise. So the next one is gentle. So mudu. Oh, actually, here it says humble. Yeah, I forget now the Pali. But gentle, humble, it's a similar thing. And I often like to think of this in terms of the right intentions. So if you remember the second factor of the path, we have the non-ill will and the letting go, or giving up of control, giving up of ownership. And then we have compassion or non-violence. And that includes gentleness. Gentleness is a kind of non-violence, a real treading lightly in the world. And I remember I was on retreat many years ago, or several years ago, with Ajahn Brahm, and I said to him, I think, you know, I'm pretty kind. Like, I have quite a lot of metta. Metta comes easy to me, and, you know, to some extent I have an understanding, a preliminary understanding of non-self, and understand that the practice is about giving and not getting, but I could be more gentle. I could definitely be more gentle with my mind. And I said, how gentle can you be? And he said, be gentler than gentle. I don't know, I found that so beautiful, because even the idea of being gentle, it's like you're there being gentle, you know, you're kind of stroking the cat or whatever, but gently. But gentler than gentle feels to me like being so unobtrusive that another being doesn't even notice that you're there. And if you take that to the mind level, you know, it's like you can be so gentle with the mind that your mind doesn't even know there's a watcher. You know, the doer starts to really disappear and really give to the process, allow the process to unfold. Because any time we kind of start to stick our fingers in, especially by the time that PT starts to arise, or the metta starts to flow, but it's still, you know, very, very delicate in a way. Like, you might not even notice it as a thing. It might be more of an absence of the kind of barriers that we erect in the heart, you know, the kind of hardness or the pushing or the trying to make something happen. So it's very, very delicate. And as soon as we kind of grab onto it, it tends to recede. It's okay to notice these dynamics, and it's good to notice, because this is where we learn what attachment is, what craving and clinging is. But just see how gentle you can be, because there are always different levels of gentleness. Of course, when it comes to speech, it's really important to speak not only with loving kindness, but also speak in a timely and a gentle way for a person's benefit. Not because it's good for you to tell them what, but because it's genuinely in their best interest. And we say it gently, which might mean if you do have to give feedback, you know, and you need to criticize to some extent, or say that something someone's done has had a certain effect that wasn't necessarily desirable, then it's always good to give that person a sense of trust, first of all. You know, say what you appreciate about them, what you value about them, and then only give the feedback. And you can also ask them, you know, are you ready to hear? Can I give you some feedback? Are you in the right mood? You know, because if a person's tired or struggling or feeling sad, it might be just the last straw, you know. I came to work and this person told me that I hadn't done something right, and, you know, the smallest of things can really tip a person into more distress. So sometimes just leading by example is enough. You don't even need to tell a person. They sort of figure it out, you know. I know that's the case for myself, you know. Sometimes I'm really relieved that somebody hasn't told me because I realise. And then I always have the opportunity to reveal that and to say, oh, I should have done this differently, you know. Maybe it hurt you or, you know, let me know next time. So the next one is being not conceited, not arrogant or conceited. And in that little book, it says this includes not despising or disregarding anybody based on superficial things like a person's race or a person's background or a person's social status. Not even choosing to hang around people because, you know, they look good or they look like you or, you know, they're young and fit. But to really choose our friends more wisely, like based on their spiritual qualities, right? And then not to put anybody else down. In one of my favourite suttas called the Aranavibhanga Sutta, it says one should not disparage others nor laud oneself. In other words, think how great I am compared to this person. And it's hard sometimes, isn't it? You know, you look at people acting in the world in unethical ways and we can easily start to create a self out of that. They are worse than I am. But this whole creating of a self is the mistake. And I think I already told you the story of the two enlightened monastics who came to the Buddha and said, one who's enlightened doesn't think they're better, worse, or even the same as anybody else. So not conceptualizing at all, yeah? But again, being drawn to people who are virtuous, you know, choosing to spend your time wisely with the virtuous is important, and guarding against this sense of conceit. Yeah, I was listening to a little talk yesterday, actually, by Bhante Sujato, because he came to visit us recently. Did he come here to Finland? Okay, next time I talk to him, I'll tell him. If you want him to come.
We tried to get him here. Yeah. But he was still too busy travelling.
Too busy, yeah. By the time he came to England, he was at the end of his trip and he was really tired. And he said, you know, although he was enjoying our company, I'm pretty sure he was. It was really great fun. He did say he's a bit homesick by then. He wanted to get back and, you know, get back into his own space. And, yeah, I can understand that if you've been on the road for like 3 or so months. But yeah, it was great when he came because he talked so much about things that other monastics often won't address. And then I saw this little talk that a friend of mine sent to me and it's called I Am an Anarchist, which is, of course, to try and grab your attention, right? Because actually he starts off by saying this talk's called Why I Am an Anarchist. But yeah, they've put it up as I Am an Anarchist and then they got a picture of him looking, you know, kind of cheeky. But I listened to this and it was so interesting because, you know, sometimes we think of anarchy as like a complete disregard for rules and regulations, but actually what it is trying to form more equitable societies based on organising ourselves around interrelationships, social networking, common values and aims, and actually disrupting power structures that are more hierarchical in nature and that always means somebody is going to be oppressed. So I thought this was really interesting and really fitted in quite well with the idea of equitable societies and democracies. And so his argument was a lot of the Vinaya, the rules and the systems that we organise ourselves around as monastics, are actually anarchist principles because we also have kind of consensus decision-making. That's one of the principles of anarchy, that you make decisions in consensus, not just in majority. Because whenever there's a majority, there's a minority that then get oppressed by the majority. So ideally, in a monastery, people should all come on board with the majority, so that creates the consensus, accepting that, you know, there are people in the community that might have more wisdom, that have been there longer, that take more responsibility for the way things run. But if somebody is really adamantly opposed to something, the Sangha can't continue. They can't go forward with that decision until that person's brought on board. And I don't know, but I saw this modelled really well in Norway on the retreat we did there. Because there was a situation where there was a mobile phone, well, quite a few mobile phones being used in the lounge. And somebody complained and said, you know, it's really distracting because I'm on retreat. I don't want to see people on their phone. And then the person on the phone said, well, I was actually reading some suttas and, you know, it's really helpful for me to be able to look on the phone. What's the difference with that and reading a book? And so we raised it in the actual session. So in a session like this, we just had a discussion. Okay, so what does everybody think about this? And everybody's opinion was taken into account, at least those who wanted to offer one. And then the organisers went away, thought about it, and came back and said, OK, we've taken everybody's opinion into account, and this is the decision. And because of that, everyone was happy, because they'd been heard. And I just thought, wow, you can see why Norway is some kind of social democracy. This is a really cool way of running things, just hearing everyone, no matter how... You know, I'm more likely to sort of think, well... I kind of make my decision pretty fast. I mean, I listen to everybody, but then the right thing to do becomes kind of clear, and it's like, I don't want to spend too much time. And I think that's one of the reasons that societies don't run as well as they could, because democracy, real democracy, takes time. It takes time for people to be heard, right? Anyway, I'm probably running away from this main gist of that last one, which is to not be arrogant or conceited, but actually I think that applies. You know, the principles of Buddhism, and apparently of anarchy, are that there's an inherent value and worth in every human being, in every living being, simply because we breathe, because we have sentience, because we're conscious. And Bhantisarjato started this little talk called I Am an Anarchist, with a story of just going out onto the street in the neighbourhood where he lives. And he met a couple of boys and a girl, 8 years old or roundabout. And one of the boys said to him, "Are monks bad?" And Bhantisarjato was a bit taken aback by that. "Are monks bad?" So he didn't answer, but the little girl piped up and she said, "We're all sisters and brothers. We should just love and respect one another, that's all." So sweet, no? Mm-hmm. And Bhante made a joke, he's like, "Do they have adoption or something?" I don't think he actually wants to adopt that child, and I'm sure the parents wouldn't be happy about it. But he said, didn't this just epitomise this spirit of treating everyone, you know, as brother, sister, sibling, because we have gender non-binary folks, and, you know, really starting to regard one another as equals, equally capable of enlightenment. The other thing the Buddha always makes clear is that we've had so many lives. I mean, whether you believe it or not, whether you can possibly know that or not until you've had a lot of deep meditation, it's quite a helpful perspective to take. I mean, for me, the idea that, you know, anyone in this room could have been my sibling, could have been my parent, my friend, my teacher in the past, is a very beautiful way. It brings a feeling of more closeness, more respect automatically when I regard people like that. And there are people that you meet that you feel connected to instantly. Like, have I met you before? You even look familiar. And who knows what we've been to each other in the past. So I find that really beautiful. And I think it's a skillful way in monasteries as well, especially male-only monasteries, where sometimes women are sort of, what's the word, vilified and seen as the problem, you know, because sometimes monks struggle with lust, and if they're heterosexual, they project it onto the women. But I think a much more beautiful way to deal with this than just say, okay, we have to like ignore women and put them like 100 kilometres away in another monastery, is just to start regarding one another as siblings, right, as parents, as aunts, as friends on the path. And this really starts to undermine those ways of looking that will actually develop unwholesome states of mind. So this is really beautiful, and I think a big training, right, to be humble and not conceited. And actually, at its depth, that is the third stage of enlightenment. Conceit still remains until then. So it's a long one. It's a long path. So the next ones... are contentment, being easy to support, a few wishes, a simple lifestyle, calm senses. So that's from number 7 to 11. And I think all of this falls under the gradual training. This is a kind of refinement of ethics, and it comes in the Majjhima Nikaya number 51 and number 125, if you want to read those suttas, and many other places as well. And being contented and easily satisfied is a foundational quality for loving kindness. I think that's really beautiful, because you're not loving another person to see what you can get. You're not loving them because there's something lacking in you and you want to have more friends, or you need this person to, you know, befriend you in some way. There's already a sense of contentment there. You know, I do count my blessings almost every day actually, almost many, many times in the day, now that we have a monastery, because it's taken so much, not just from me, but from the kindness of others. I mean, as a nun, I don't handle money. I can't actually go out there and do anything to kind of bring money in, or even bring people in, other than just share the Dhamma that I've practiced and felt inspired by, and to some extent understood. And, you know, to the best of my ability, try to bring people together through inspiring others about the benefit of having spiritual friends and practicing in community. So the whole project has been made possible by actually thousands of people around the world. And I remember some of the first donations that were collected. I saw a photo of this wonderful-looking Sri Lankan woman, an older lady, with a big Anukampa poster. And I didn't even know this person, standing in Sri Lanka with this huge poster of me and Ajahn Brown. It was the very first tour. And I thought, wow, she's like, you know, promoting us over there. And she did this big collection of about 100 people or so. And some were just offering like 2 or 3 rupees, which is like less than a penny. And others were offering like, I don't know, $10, $100, whatever. But it included so many people from different walks of life. And it was the most touching kind of gesture, you know, that somebody was making. And these kind of things, you know, although, you know, relatively humble, really gave me the energy and inspiration to just continue to carry on. So, yeah, counting one's blessings in life is so easy when we recognize that our lives are made possible by, you know, countless beings, beings that we don't even know, beings that plant the food, grow the crops, harvest them, bring them to the supermarket, or the cashiers at the desk, you know, our parents who've given us birth, their parents back to who knows how far. Our lives are made possible through kindness and the gifts of others. And we reflect on this every day as monastics. It really brightens the mind and makes it much harder to fall into fault finding. So being contented, and being contented in our meditation, makes it possible to stay in the present moment, right? It's those winds of discontent that literally blow us into the future, or kind of, yeah, drag us into the past. Because we're not content right now where we are. We're not seeing the beauty. We're not counting the blessing of just having a moment of silence to ourselves. So then being easy to support, I think, is kind of obvious. We're not, again, demanding in nature. We don't demand for others give us particularly special food or special gifts. I mean, of course, if we have a health condition, that's okay, but we're basically satisfied. And having few wishes. How many wishes do all of you have? Do you wish that the next meditation is as good or better than the last? Or can you put those wishes down completely? Because sometimes we think having wishes, having cravings, having desires is actually, you know, a source of happiness. There's a buzz, isn't there, from having a desire. There's like a sense of anticipation or excitement. But after a while, when we meditate, we see that actually it's not just that craving causes suffering. The very moment you move into craving, or you move into a sense of lack and start wishing things are different, that in itself is suffering. Right? Any sense of lack is suffering. There's an absence there. There's a separation between where you are and where you want to be. That's one of Ajahn Brahm's definitions of suffering, the gap between where you are right now and where you want to be. So the way to resolve that is to make where you are the place you want to be. So we become increasingly contented and start looking for the beauty in the moment. One of the other qualities that's said to give rise to loving kindness is looking for the beauty or the lovable nature in beings. So not just in the moment, but in beings themselves. And all beings have something that's lovable, something that's worthy of respect and admiration. And by being able to see that, even in someone we don't really appreciate, the fact that they're alive, the fact that they're breathing, you know, they hope for their own happiness, even if they're going about it the wrong way, causes at least a sense of compassion to arise in our hearts. So I'll stop soon because there's quite a few more qualities, but the one I want to really draw out here, the fewness of wishes and the simple lifestyle, you can see how all of these are leading to a sense of lightness, a sense of ease, a sense of being able to breathe, and also being not busy with duties, right? That means not having duties and not taking our responsibility. We take our responsibility and we try and do things in a way that's efficient and, you know, productive. We focus on the task. We maybe don't have too many things all at once, like, okay, this email, then something on Facebook, then something here, then something on WhatsApp, which I must say can be my life sometimes. But we try to simplify so that we take on the duties that are important and that can really have some benefit for ourselves and for society. And we put down those trivial activities like, I don't know, hanging out too long in the lunch break or gossiping with friends or things we don't really need to do, taking on other people's emotional baggage. You know, sometimes we think it's our job to keep a person happy and manage their moods. Does anyone have that kind of burden in their life? Yeah. So we're moving into areas that are not our concern and we're losing our emotional boundaries. So we have some boundaries, some sense of this is my responsibility and this is yours. And we wish people well with theirs, but we don't take on what is not ours to take on. So we try to keep our burdens light. In fact, thinking of them as burdens is not very helpful. Sometimes in monasteries we think of them, they say, oh, it's time to talk about the chores. And I think that's such a terrible word because a chore in English means it's a real drag. So I much prefer to call the work meeting a kindful service meeting. We should put that in the guest guidelines, kindful service period, not chores and not duties and not work. So the next one is calm senses. I think here it says something else. Peaceful and calm. But the actual Pali is santindriyo, which means calm senses. So the indriyas are our sense doors, so that means the senses of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, and also the sense impressions that we have going through our mind. So, of course, the more that we put in through the senses, the more that we absorb and take in, the more we're going to have spinning around our mind as well. Because if you've noticed, a lot of our thinking process is about sight, sound, smells, tastes and touch. And the kind of feelings we want to have, right? Or feelings we've had in the past that we want to get back again. So one of the really important ways of calming the mind in preparation for meditation is to learn to guard our senses in a way that quietens the mind and leads again to the wholesome states arising. So I like to call sense restraint more like guarding the senses, because we have to have sense impressions. You know, if I'm teaching, I think, I don't know, how would it feel if I just closed my eyes and taught? It might feel a bit strange. I don't know, maybe you like that. But for me, it would be strange. So I have to look at people because I want to get emotional feedback. I want to feel the energy in the room and notice if you're yawning and notice, I mean, okay, I won't take too much responsibility for that. But at the same time, you know, you want to feel how things land for people. So we have to have a certain amount of sensory impression. But we can actually look at the space between ourself and that sense impression and see how we're relating to it. You know, if I'm looking at you, am I feeling, you know, wholesome qualities arise, or am I focusing in a way that makes me irritated? Yeah? So if we look at a person only in terms of their faults or the things that cause us to feel angry and upset, then that is not wise use of the senses. We need to actively search for things that bring up a sense of compassion or a sense of kindness towards a person. In the same way, we don't look at a person in a way that kind of gives rise to lust or attachment. As I was saying, we can learn to regard one another as brothers and sisters on the path. Yeah, and this is a way of calming the senses because we're not left with unfinished business to do. And of course, there's another aspect to this, which is to actually quieten the senses down completely. And this is something we can do when we're in retreat. So when you actually leave the meditation room, you don't have to immediately start kind of filling your mind with sensory input. Looking at nature is a beautiful thing to do because that's naturally calming. But even more than that is just staying inside with whatever feelings are arising through the process of meditation. Even staying with the phrases or staying with the breath. You know, you can bring metta, you can bring loving kindness to the breath. And there are a couple of really nice similes that I'll just let you know about because there's so much to talk about in 2 days, but maybe some of you can look into these after the retreat. And this is in the Indriya Samyutta, which is Samyutta Nikaya number 35, chapter 35. And in there are 2 suttas about guarding the senses or calming, quietening the senses down. Actually, there are many. There's more than 2. One of the most famous ones was the Buddha's 3rd sermon, and that was a sutta called the Fire Sermon. And there he talked about the senses being on fire with greed, hate and delusion. And many other things too, birth, ageing, sickness and death, suffering, sorrow, etc. But these other suttas that I want to talk about briefly are talking about the practice of sense restraint. And the first one is about seeing the senses like animals. So the Buddha said it's like we've got a jackal, a snake, a dog, a monkey, I think, and something else, I forget. So the senses are like these animals, and they're kind of all pulling in their own direction. And they're tied together, but they're not tied to anything else. So wherever the strongest one pulls, all the rest get dragged along. Yeah. So this is just like our senses. If there's a really strong, impactful sight, all our energy gets pulled in that direction. You know, and we kind of lose our senses. We lose touch with what's happening at the other sense doors. But then what you can do is tie these animals to a post. And that post is like mindfulness of the body. So you tie all these separate animals to this pillar. And they keep trying to pull in their own direction. Yeah. So the dog goes to the town, the jackal goes to the graveyard, the monkey goes to the forest. Oh, the bird is the other one, and that tries to go off into the sky. Fly off into the sky. But because of this post of mindfulness, because you're tied to this post, in other words, you have a center, you have a kind of foundation for your mindfulness to rest on. Eventually these animals quieten down. And then they kind of curl up around the post, and even the bird finds a perch, and then they go to sleep, they rest. So this is one really nice simile, and it doesn't have to be mindfulness of the body. That's a really easy way to practice and something we can apply in everyday life, but it can also be thoughts of loving kindness that we return to. Yeah. So you see something that starts to incite anger or irritation. Oh, may this person be happy. You know, may I abide in loving kindness. May I not neglect the practice of love. So we return to our object. And then the next one, I hope this is not too much, but I just love these suttas. Okay, the last one for the day, for the morning, is a simile of a jackal and a dog. So these are all about animals. And this one's really nice. I think of this one more as quietening the senses, so really staying inside. So this is about a tortoise, I think, that goes on a walk, and then he senses that there's a jackal nearby that wants to pounce and eat this tortoise, you know. And, of course, the tortoise knows that it needs to draw in its limbs in order not to be hurt. So it draws its limbs and its neck and its tail. I think it's 6, right? So you've got the tail and the head. So it's like the 6 senses. You even draw your mind in, into the shell. And the tortoise just waits. And the jackal's looking. The minute this tortoise puts out its limb, I'm going to grab that tortoise and eat it alive. But the jackal, the tortoise, knows what's happening. So it just stays inside and it stays inside and waits until the danger passes. So this is also something we can do in our lives. If we know that we're going out into the streets and there's going to be all kinds of compelling kind of adverts, sort of screaming for your attention, or I don't know, maybe there's some kind of hazard that you might trip up on. You just focus your mind. You know you're going into that place, so you keep your senses inside. You keep very mindful of where you're walking and you just go from A to B. You know, it's an example of being outside. But in our meditation, we can also just determine to keep our minds inside. It doesn't matter if somebody else is coughing or snoring or closing the door. You know, we know that if we get pulled out, we're going to lose that momentum in the practice. And Mara might strike at any time. So not to be afraid, but just to find that comfortable place inside and to learn the beauty of having the senses pacified and how that conduces to the happiness within. The unblemished happiness is what the Buddha taught. The happiness of sense restraint. So the last ones are being prudent, which actually means, I don't think they've got prudent here, wise and skillful, I think. So that means really being skilled in making good decisions, having some discernment. So we're not just saying, may all beings be happy, may I be happy, and then kind of putting yourself in the middle of a fight or something. You have discernment. Yeah? You know how to make decisions. And being courteous and polite, not attached to anyone in particular, because you can see that attachment is a impurity of love. It means that we're valuing some people over others, and really what it means is we're having preferences. We care about some more than others because of what they mean to us, what they do for us. And lastly, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. So we're talking about really becoming purified in our virtuous conduct. You know, and we can use that as a guideline, like would someone that I respect, would a wise person do what I'm doing? You know, what would they say? They'd probably be very forgiving, but would you feel that you could tell your teacher? So just using that as a little guideline. Could a wise person reprove me for this conduct? Could they criticize me here? And you don't have to criticize yourself, but just use it as a guideline to really see that your body, speech and mind is as pure as possible. And that will make metta practice very, very easy. So all of these guidelines here lead to that lightness, that sense of a clear conscience, and also some happiness before you even begin. And I think that's why the Buddha laid out a gradual training. You know, he wasn't saying come to the meditation cushion with all your unfinished business. He was saying, you know, really get yourself in a good condition first. Have a sense of happiness. Have a sense of ease in your life as best you possibly can. And from that place, start to go inside. So I offer this for your reflection this morning. And I would like to invite you to take a little break. And we will do some more meditation.